Welcome to Boxes and Lines, a different kind of finance podcast from a different kind of stock exchange, featuring IEX founder Ronan Ryan and Chief Market Policy Officer John Ramsey. Now here to give you the straight talk on how the markets really work, it's Ronan and JR.
Welcome everybody to the latest episode of Boxes and Lines.
Welcome to Boxes and Lanes.
Our guest today, Ellen, and you'll soon learn, just let him go, is Ellen Correa-Golay. Oh, fuck. I said it right the first time.
You were good the first time.
We're already having you do editing, Jacob. Okay. So our guest today is Ellen Correa-Golay, a treasury markets advisor in the markets group at the New York Federal Reserve Bank.
Very well done.
Thank you. She leads cross-asset work related to market resilience and is an expert in the U.S. treasury market structure and fixed income, which John will probably tell us he worked in a minute. Ellen's understanding and her contribution to policy design and market resilience make her voice to listen to in the world of finance, and we're happy to have her here to unpack the complexities of the Treasury's market. Did that sound like I just read it?
It did actually sound like you did just read it, but that's okay.
But that's the brilliance of me. I didn't. And before Ellen introduces herself, she must give a disclaimer, which we're okay with because we work a lot with people from the SEC. And they generally do the same. Welcome, Ellen. Thank you for joining us.
Great. Thanks for having me. And yes, I have to do the obligatory disclaimer. I'll just start with that the views I express are my own, not those of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York or the Federal Reserve System.
Very good. Thank you.
I do understand that. And you know, I don't know if you know, Ellen, I used to have a senior job at the SEC.
Yes.
And so I had to do that disclaimer.
If you listen to a fraction of any of our podcasts, you know all of this. A little tidbit.
Okay, tidbit.
Fire away, John.
Thank you. You were
very gregarious before the podcast on your this topic here. So I'm going to let you go first.
It actually is interesting, I think, because usually we talk about equities markets, but fixed income markets, and particularly the treasuries market, hugely important to the economy and functioning of the financial system, et cetera. So can you talk a little bit about overall thoughts about, for people who are maybe don't think about the treasury market that much, relative size of the treasury market, how it is that it affects the economy, and then a little bit about how you all at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, how you participate or are involved in the treasury market?
Sure, happy to. So I don't off the top of my head have the size of the treasury market, but we always like to say it's the deepest and most liquid securities market in the world. It's super actively traded. So treasuries, maybe if I just kind of really step back, what is a treasury security?
Yeah, please, because we have a lot of crazy listeners who are not even from this industry.
Right.
Yeah. And for John's benefit.
Thank you.
So a treasury security is basically the way that the U.S. Treasury borrows money to make up the difference between its revenues and its expenditures. And so it issues a security, and on that security, it pays interest. And so the person who buys the security loans treasury money and receives interest in return. These securities are hugely valuable in the market because the treasury is viewed as free of risk. And so they're riskless. It's a giant market. And so that makes it the benchmark for basically all other financial markets. So
free of risk because it's backed by the U.S.
Backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government.
Perfect.
So exactly.
Yep.
So as a result, that means that the rates on treasuries really kind of serve as the benchmark rate for every other interest rate in financial markets. So if you're thinking about the interest rate on your credit card bill, your mortgage rate, you know, any other, the rate you get on your savings account, it all comes back to the rates on treasuries.
And then I assume that part of why it's important too is that the ability to efficiently issue and trade in the secondary market, treasury securities, is sort of supports the function of the, I mean, the dollar is sort of the world's kind of like standard currency reserve.
It's definitely a virtuous circle between the dollar and U.S. treasuries, where, you know, U.S. treasuries are liquid, they're viewed as the benchmark security, and so they're super actively traded, which means dollars are super actively traded. And because dollars are super actively traded, people want to buy treasuries. So the two markets reinforce each other.
Right. And so how is it that the New York Fed is involved in the market? Because I think the interesting thing about the New York Federal Reserve Bank is I think about it as a unique kind of public-private partnership that sort of draws on experience of people in the industry. So I'd be interested to hear your
thoughts.
Yeah, like there's a bunch of branches too, right? And then when people hear Federal Reserve, they think of the Federal Reserve itself where –
Yep.
You know, Bruce Willis helped them stop the gold robbery.
That was the New York Fed, actually. Yeah, Die Hard 3.
Yeah, see, it shows what you know. Yeah, there you go.
Yes, so that was
actually. Well, a lot of listeners are like me.
Ronan is the stand-in for all of our more ignorant listeners.
You can rob City Hall.
Anyway. The funniest thing about that movie is, you know, a brick of gold is very heavy. So the idea that they're just like driving out with a ton of gold. Yeah. With, like, you know.
It was a pretty good movie.
You are actually storing gold over
we
there
do. Yes.
In the building.
Yes, we
underneath.
Have a gold vault. Yes.
So how hard is it to get into the gold vault?
It's extremely hard.
Wait, is it? Okay.
I hope that was your answer.
Can you let Ronan and me in one day just to kind of like.
I mean, there are visitor tours.
Okay.
Oh, really?
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Whether that will be possible or not, I'll have to pause.
Probably after this podcast, perhaps not.
Yeah, we're going to make
it. It's theoretically possible.
Yeah, okay.
We're going to edit that out because you're just going to get us blacklisted.
So maybe I'll talk a little bit about the Fed's role in the Treasury market, and then I could talk about the New York Fed specifically.
Yeah, we'll stop talking.
So I'm happy to hear everything you guys have to say. So the Federal Reserve, as you know, sets monetary policy for the U.S. economy, and it implements monetary policy in financial markets, and in particular in the U.S. Treasury market. The overnight reverse repo program is this reverse repo on Treasury securities that sets a floor on interest rates. The standing repo facility provides a source for funding Treasury securities through repo. Over the past, we've done large-scale asset purchases of Treasury securities. After the great financial crisis, that was to put downward pressure on longer term rates. In 2020, that was to restore the market functioning in the Treasury market, which had deteriorated significantly. Mm-hmm. So the Federal Reserve System is very active in its policies through the Treasury market. In terms of the New York Fed in particular, the markets group at the New York Fed is the policy implementation arm of the Federal Reserve System. So we're the ones who are repoing, reverse repoing, buying, and I in particular led the purchases in 2020. So we're the ones, you know, on the other side of those trades. But the New York Fed also has a special role in that we are the ones who gather market intelligence for the Federal Reserve System, and we funnel that to policymakers. And so that's where we have a lot of connection points with private market participants, like the Treasury Markets Practices Group, which is a group of private market practitioners that develop best practices for the Treasury agency debt and agency MBS markets.
Yes. And one thing that Ronan did not know, but I've been saving it until this point, is that
he worked there.
I did sit as a representative on the Treasury Market Practices Group when
I hired this guy. I clearly never looked at his resume. But almost every podcast, he's worked in some way. Yeah. He's like 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon.
This is a long time ago, but solicited my friend Michael, who's still there. But anyway, pre-financial crisis, I worked at Citigroup. So a representative from Citigroup on that group which is really designed. Well, you can sort of explain what they're in designed to do, but kind of to establish a set of best practices for trading, secondary trading.
Exactly.
Can I ask a more basic question just for a second? So obviously financial crisis long ago, but 2020 is fairly recent.
Yes.
And you talked about some measures that you guys did in 2020, I guess, to stabilize things.
Yep.
Can you elaborate on that a little more simply for us none? I didn't work in Treasury, and seemingly John did. Mm-hmm. I'd just be curious what that sort of means. Like, what's a basic approach that was? Well, I know it's not basic.
Yep. So in March 2020, as the concerns about the pandemic started, there began to be very large strains in the Treasury market. We call this called the dash for cash. Basically, what was happening is that while Treasuries are very valued and viewed as risk-free and close to cash, the people were so worried in the pandemic that they really just wanted actual cash.
They wanted actual cash.
Exactly. And since Treasuries are the largest asset that people hold when they want a cash substitute, and because it's such a large market, And because dollars are the reserve currency, put all that together, the wave of selling of treasuries was just massive.
Okay.
And it just led to a complete breakdown in treasury market functioning.
Okay. Which is like in any financial market, is if everybody seems to be heading for the exits at the same time,
yes,
then you've got...
It's very, very hard to...
I didn't realize that happened, but obviously people were panicking back then. So then what did you do to try to reverse that?
So there was a couple things we did. First, the New York Fed, at the direction of the FOMC, started doing very large repos to try and address the flow. However, you know, what we were finding was that this wasn't kind of a temporary financing flow. This was massive sales, primarily ended up with the dealers because the dealers are the ones who typically intermediate these large client flows.
And repos are just basically a form of financing transaction where people are exchanging treasuries for cash.
Exactly. So it's a temporary.
I gotcha. Yeah.
Exactly. It's exactly that. It's a repurchase agreement. So the idea is I sell you a treasury today and I'm going to buy it back tomorrow. And so it helps with that financing flow. But if you're in a situation where there's a mass sale of treasuries, it could only do so much. So that was step one. Then step two, what we did was we did very large purchases of treasury securities. And we were buying as much in a day as we used to buy in a month in the prior purchase programs, like the $70, $80 billion a day range, and then doing similarly large purchases of mortgage-backed securities as well. And, you know, that was really just to deal with this breakdown in market functioning, because a breakdown in, of course, a breakdown in the treasury market is, you know, very challenging for the treasury market. But because the treasury market is the benchmark for so many other financial markets, there were breakdowns in many, many other financial markets that trade off of treasuries. So without there being functioning in the treasury market, it just rippled across the whole financial system. So we, you know, acted as quickly as we could to restore functioning to the treasury market.
Did it rebound quick? Like our world in equities, right? Obviously the, I think it was the week of March 16th, all stock prices went down.
Yep.
And then a couple of weeks later, everything started riding up.
Yep. So, I mean, in terms of restoring functioning, it took a while, you know, and we were every day we were buying, and then we were looking at the metrics and being like, did we do it? And then we were like, no, make it bigger, buy metrics. Yeah. And of course, you know, in the committee directing us, you know, for all of this as well.
Yep.
But we're trying to calibrate each day what to do. And so I think by June, things had gotten to a place that we moved to a steady state of purchases of $80 billion a month that was more similar to traditional QE type purchases.
Okay.
But it took, I mean, I think it, like by the end of April, a lot of the improvements in liquidity and market function had been made. But it was, I mean, those first, the first week or two, it felt like we were doing things we didn't even think we could do, that it was just unbelievable. You know, we were just buying all day long. And the first few days, it was like the needle wasn't moving. And it took a little while.
Yeah.
I think about it as sort of like bridging that kind of confidence gap where people, you know, sort of period of time when people start to become comfortable that the world is not actually coming unglued and things will, and allowing, giving space for people to be able to catch their breath and things to normalize. And most people, I think, don't appreciate or are not cognizant of the small army of people, not just the, you know, at the Fed, at the New York Fed, and in other agencies that are kind of working behind the scenes to be able to, particularly in the kind of emergency situations, sort of restore confidence.
I wasn't. That was really interesting. Thank you.
Yeah.
See, you learn something every day.
Yeah.
John.
Well, there you go. If you just keep your ears open,
well, you just didn't want to
listen.
You didn't know.
No, I know.
Yeah,
I knew.
I know when you're nodding a certain way that you're full of shit.
Obviously, it's a unique situation. It's not like the onset of a global pandemic is something that happens frequently. But are there things that you guys, other policymakers, are focused on in terms of trying to create some backups or fail safes and limiting the potential for these kinds of situations to recur?
Yeah, definitely. So I would say that the 2020 experience definitely put renewed focus on the importance of the resilience of the treasury market, and that the official sector kind of really redouble its efforts to ensure the resilience of the treasury market. So the Interagency Working Group for Treasury Market Surveillance is a group of official sector staff that works together to ensure the resilience of the Treasury market. So that includes staff from the SEC, the CFTC, the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve, the Treasury, and New York Fed. So that group has been working together since 2020 on a set of work streams and policy work to try and advance initiatives to improve the resilience of the Treasury market. You know, some of the recent rules finalized by the SEC has been part of that work. We've done research on things like all-to-all trading as part of that work. There's been work on data and transparency as part of those initiatives. And there's the belief that, you know, what happened in 2020, and as you said before, when everyone's running for the exits, when everyone's going in the same direction, that's a really hard market situation.
Yeah.
And while it would have been ideal if the intermediation had been there, there wasn't a lot of demand on the buy side at that time. And so in those tail situations, official sector action like what we had has to happen. But it would be ideal to reduce the frequency of those situations and reduce the severity of them. And by improving the resilience of the market, hopefully we can do that. And so that's kind of where, basically what I want to say is when the goal is not make 2020 never have happened or make sure that will never happen again. That's in an event like that, in a global pandemic.
Yeah.
There's going to be market difficulties, and it may require official sector action, but we want to make the market resilient so that the frequency of those events are few and the severity of them are smaller.
And you're never going to eliminate the need in particular circumstances for regulators to be able to act on the fly and to be able to, you know, things to sort of like run on a steady state basis and never worry about having to do extraordinary interventions. That's just
That's just part of life of
these
for sure. Well, how
being
would you,
in the policy world.
I mean, God, I can't believe it's already almost 4 years, but like 4 years later, like how would you assess current resilience?
I think we've definitely seen some improvements. I moderated a panel at a conference last fall on exactly on this topic. And the takeaway from the panel was basically that while the market, particularly in 2023, the Treasury market was pretty volatile, but that it really held up despite the volatility. You know, there was some, you know, widening in bid-ask spreads and, you know, worsening some liquidity measures. But that worsening, based on research done by my colleague Michael Fleming, was really commensurate with the increase in volatility. It's basically what you would expect.
Okay.
So honestly, the market has recently held up well, and that's likely due in part to some of the initiatives that have been taken since the 2020 events, the introduction of the standing repo facility and the Foreign and International Monetary Authority repo facilities. These are two facilities for the standing repo market participants. For the FEMA repo, foreign and international monetary accounts can go and get cash for their treasuries. And, you know, in an extreme situation like 2020, that could help that kind of situation.
So you don't have to create that sort of facility on the fly.
It's just it's there. Exactly. Yeah. Standing repo facility. Mm-hmm. It's just there.
It's like the Batman light.
Exactly.
Yes, I will wait to dumb it down. But yes, very well done.
I saw you looking confused again.
I would say, though, I don't think the market's really been tested like it was in 2020. It's been more resilient recently, but, you know, we haven't, you know, the strains last March with the regional bank challenges, you know, that was a moment and the market held up well, but we haven't really seen anything close to 2020 since. And so the market's doing well, but I don't know that's been truly tested yet.
And one other aspect of resiliency that's fairly timely, I think, too, has to do with the changing nature of the participants in the Treasury market. So going back a long time, but traditionally, my sense was most of the trading among dealers in the Treasury markets was by large banks that are primary dealers in the Treasury markets have this kind of official sort of status. And that's been replaced over time to a large extent, supplanted, supplemented by principal trading firms that are, you know, sort of term high-speed trading firms, but firms that are may not be regulated as dealers. And so one of the things that the SEC recently did was, from their perspective, sort of closing that gap. More of these principal trading firms involved, in particular in the Treasury markets, will be required to register. So anything you want to say about that? How does that...
I was wondering when the question was coming.
I knew what the question was.
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
Don't defend him, Ellen.
Thank you, Ellen. She
I thought
got
you
it.
And I were going to pick on John.
She got it.
This is a...
There's a question coming. Mm-hmm.
I was closely watching this yesterday because it was the SEC meeting voting on this rule was yesterday. You know, I think the principal trading firms, PTFs, have become a very large part on the run market. The on the run treasury market is the trading in the most recently issued treasury securities. And that market's largely electronic. And so that's the main reason the PTFs are very active there. A lot of them use high frequency strategies. Right. And that's where those strategies are able to be successful. And, you know, I think this is an example of how the market innovating and then regulators learning from the market innovation and then regulators adapting to the market innovation. You know, as you said, right. 20 odd years ago, all of the trading on interdealer brokers like BrokerTec were dealers, right?
Right.
Today, I don't have exactly the numbers, but analysis from 2018, Fed analysis showed that 62% of that trading was PTFs. So, you know, they're a very large part of that trading on the electronic trading platforms. But until this rule was voted, they were not regulated as dealers.
Right. At least not all of them, or some number of them were not. And so you have this scenario, nothing wrong about participation of high-speed trading firms in this market, additional source of liquidity, all of that is fine. But then you have the situation where if the market comes to depend on this alternate source of liquidity, and it's being provided by people who don't have kind of the traditional obligations of a primary dealer, for example, to sort of to support the market in times of stress, then the concern is that you need some regulatory oversight.
Is that the primary obligation, like elevator pitch, what was voted on yesterday?
Ellen, you give your perspective. My sense is the overall point was that if there are firms that are providing a source of liquidity and providing quotes that are disseminated to other firms in the marketplace, and they have and other participants have the ability to trade against those quotes, then those people should be regulated as dealers because they're performing a dealer function.
What does it mean, like being a dealer? You have more obligations, more regulatory obligations.
You have to register with the SEC
as
either a regular dealer or a government securities dealer, and then you have to become a FINRA member and sort of like all of that.
That's right. And then, you know, there are other things that happen, you know, also as a result. So if you're a FINRA member, then your trades get reported into the trade reporting compliance engine, TRACE.
Okay.
So that means any trades by dealers are in this data set that the official sector can use to understand the market. So
by dealer name or just an aggregator?
They go in by name, but the data we can see is largely anonymized.
So similar to
I mean, they're on the official sector side, you know, there's some breakdowns, but it's generally anonymized. And then there's other, you know, the SEC recently came out with a rule to expand central clearing in the treasury market, which, you know, that this is kind of a watershed moment for the treasury market. It would be a very large change to how the treasury market operates, because unlike the equities market, for example, much of the treasury market is not centrally cleared today. And this rule over a 2.5-year timeline will move more of it into central clearing.
Which means that more of the trades between large market participants are just bilaterally cleared, that you can have the potential for significant concentrations of risk. And if one side or another runs into trouble, then you get systemic problems.
The way it currently is.
Correct. Yeah, right. So there will be more centrally.
So, cleared. So, you know, based on my like rough numbers, about over 3 trillion or so of repo trades would likely need to move into central clearing under this new rule. And then for the interdealer broker trades, these trades that we're discussing, there's an estimate from 2017 of around 125 billion or so would move in. So it's a pretty significant amount of trades that today are not cleared that when the rule is fully implemented, will be. And with PTFs becoming dealers, not only will trades need to be cleared that they do over interdealer brokers, but any trades that they do with other dealers will also need to be cleared.
Was the central clearing met with resistance as well? Like, obviously, I know the dealer proposal was.
My sense is that one was, but I think it was that there was more consensus around that. I don't know if it was unanimously approved at the commission, but I think it was.
I forget the commission voting, but it was less. Yeah. It was, I forget if it was 4-1 or or 5-0, yeah, but it was not 3-2.
Less contentious.
Yes. Yeah. I think the central clearing is a little more, you know, like motherhood and apple pie. Everyone can see the benefits of, you know, you're reducing counterparty risk by moving things into central clearing. Should I explain for a minute what it means to centrally
clear? Sure, yeah, that'd be helpful.
Basically, if you centrally clear a trade, what happens is two different counterparties submit their trades to the central clearing agency, and that the central clearing agency becomes the counterparty to their trades. Yeah. So in when you submit all your trades to central clearing, all your counterparty risk is basically goes down from maybe, you know, 50 or 100 of the different firms you originally did the trade with down to one, the central clearing agency. And the same happens for the other counterparties. Also, what happens is the trades are netted down. So, you know, if I do a trade with Ronan does it with John, and then we submit all of that to central clearing, they'll just take you out, right? And it'll just be me and John. And so that really helps with just the flows of settlements. It helps with fails. If I fail, I only fail John now. It's helpful on that front. It provides consistent risk management practices across the market. And then it provides the official sector visibility into the clearing and settlement that's occurring in the market. So there's a lot of benefits to central clearing. Yep. There's costs associated with it. And that's, you know, everyone's main downside.
And you are, in a sense, are also centralizing the risk. So it means that it assumes the importance of having close government oversight about how those risks are being managed.
It's not that the, you know, some risks are reduced through the netting, but the risk is centralized. And so it's important that that centralized risk be very carefully managed. And that is something some people do worry about central clearing. Those, you know, the ones who are maybe not as strong proponents of it, they worry about centralizing the risk.
And that's been a key function of how the equity markets have functioned for many years, that essentially all of the trades are centrally cleared through the NSCC, National Securities Clearing Corporation.
Right, which is that, you know, it's all part of DTCC, we have a similar organization on the fixed income side.
Right.
Very, very good. I thought we'd zoom in a little bit on Ellen.
Zoom in, shall we? Let's zoom in.
Are super broad, so a little bit more focused on your expertise. You co-authored a paper, All-to-All Trading in the U.S. Treasury Markets, and this was in 2022. In layman's terms, we keep asking you to do, but we're a very equity-centric listenership here, or no capital markets listenership. What is all-to-all trading and how does it impact markets?
Sure. I mean, so all-to-all trading probably won't be too hard for you all to grasp, because I think it's much how equities trade.
Yeah.
Right, but it's not how treasuries trade. Maybe it's just helpful to start a little bit about how the treasury market does trade, and then I could talk about why all-to-all would be interesting in the treasury market. So the treasury market is bifurcated into two segments, and this is kind of what we were talking about before. There's this interdealer segment that we were talking about. It's largely on electronic trading exchanges. It's largely dealers, large banks, and principal trading firms, and it's mostly the most recently issued securities, the on-the-run securities. Then the rest of the market is the dealer-to-customer market. And that's basically every end customer you could think of, like foreign central banks, asset managers, pension funds, hedge funds. They all largely go through dealers to trade their securities. And in that market, you will see on-the-run trading, but you also see a lot of trading of less liquid securities, like off-the-run securities, the older securities, treasury inflation-protected securities, things like that. So the idea behind all-to-all trading would be kind of to merge those two and say that any market participant could very easily trade with any other market participant. And they wouldn't need to go through an intermediary to find that other side of the trade. They would just go to an exchange or someplace
match up.
Yep. Right. And this does not really exist that much in the treasury market today. It does a bit for on the runs, the interdealer brokers, that electronic trading. It is pretty all to all for the ones who can be members of those interdealer brokers. There are also new trading methods that have come about, like anonymous request for a quote. And in that type of trading, you go onto a platform and you can send out a request for quote, which is basically saying, I want to buy this security, please give me your prices. And you can send that out to basically everyone else on the platform that is set up on anonymous request for quote. That's another kind of all-to-all like trading. All-to-all, some of the other benefits it would bring is increased price transparency. You know, as I said, a lot of the less liquid trading in the treasury market is bilateral, dealer to customer. Yeah. And so those prices are not seen as those trades are executed. And, you know, some more all-to-all like trading would increase pricing transparency.
The trades, when they're consummated, are not even reported?
They're reported into TRACE.
Yeah.
As long as you actually have a regulated dealer member, that's sort of
right.
Your,
yeah, right.
Okay. I see.
Yeah. But so TRACE on a transaction level is available to the official sector. There's aggregate TRACE daily statistics that are available to the public, but not trade by trade.
But it's aggregate end of day.
And yes, wow. Exactly. Okay. Yes. That's also quite different from a lot of other markets.
Yep.
And so this is something where if there were more all-to-all trading, it would provide that better transparency into the trading that's going on. There's some views that increased central clearing might pave the way to all-to-all, mm-hmm. You know, we'll see. To me, it seems like the bigger issue versus central clearing for why it hasn't been broadly adopted is that all-to-all has been most successful in the highly liquid, high volume segments of the treasury market, like the on-the-run market. Right. But where the liquidity is really needed and where this mm-hmm. matching is would really be beneficial is in the less liquid securities. Exactly. And so it's kind of like a chicken and an egg thing. Like if someone built some kind of platform for this, could it be successful? Maybe, but there's been some attempts, it hasn't yet been. So it's kind of a market structure issue in the treasury market.
And it kind of raises the age old question that you face in various other markets too, where if there's the potential value from this, can you rely on private sector firms to sort of arrive at this improvement on their own, or does it require some kind of mandate or should we say regulatory nudge to sort of get there?
Yeah. And that's a question, you know, in the swaps market, they were, you know, nudged to the swaps execution facilities. And so that, you know, that kind of changed the structure of that market. But, you know, in the treasury market, nothing like that has happened.
And then there's a nudge and then there's like a baseball bat, you know, it's like different levels of encouragement. Yeah.
So look, this stuff is like everything we talk about, it's pretty complex. But so how do you at the New York Fed strike the balance then between ensuring financial stability, which of course is important, but encouraging innovation in market practice as well? Like how do you skate the edge there? Is that the right term?
No, I don't think it is, but I think she gets the point.
Yeah.
I think she gets the question.
Thank you, John. I'm editing your part.
Yeah,
I mean, I think...
The prescient question.
I think... Innovation in financial markets is generally beneficial for the functioning of the financial markets. You know, if you use the PTFs as an example, they've brought a ton of liquidity to buy or sell into the electronic trading of the treasury market. That's a good thing. You know, so I think innovation is important and it's something, you know, we private sector, official sector, you know, want to be supportive of. But at the same time, it's important that, you know, the market is treated with care. It's a critical market. And so that's where the regulators are, you know, try to adapt to the innovations and try to design regulations so that they can address any risks that might be coming out of the market innovations.
Yeah.
I don't have any point of view that innovation is bad for the market. I think it's beneficial, but it's important that it be done in a careful way and that the risks be managed.
Yeah, in our market, people are always about the unintended consequences and all that stuff. Totally get it. Sorry, John, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, in terms of figuring out how you strike that balance, one of the things that I think that the New York Fed does particularly well is create all of these mechanisms for getting input from private sector participants, people who are directly involved in sort of helping both to create best practices and just recommendations for if you're thinking about regulatory change.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. The interaction with the private sector is key to understanding how these markets work. And so the TMPG provides that. We host an annual conference on the treasury market that is co-sponsored by the IAWG agencies. And that conference is really about bringing together the private sector, academics, and the official sector to discuss the current issues in the treasury market and how we can improve. And so that's a critical touch point. TMPG is a critical touch point. There's a lot of other interactions. And it's not just the New York Fed. You know, each of the regional Federal Reserves have their own touch points with their own local markets and leaders of their economy. And, you know, so there's a lot of ways that the Federal Reserve system and the New York Fed in particular gets information from the private market to try and make the best policies.
Nice. Listen, this has been excellent. You've been excellent. But we have a closing question for you.
Oh, yeah. Were you prepped about that?
I was.
Yes, I
was. Oh, good. All right.
I hope so. Because if you don't answer it well, you don't get a pair of socks.
But
if
you do. Well, that's bullshit. Everybody gets a pair of socks.
No. You got to put them at pressure.
Okay, all right.
Anyway, she has the question already. I think this is a good one. So if you could give a one-sentence piece of financial advice to your younger self, young Ellen, what would it be?
So I thought about this a bit. So, you know, I'm kind of a classic central banker. I'm kind of risk averse, and I was raised by my parents to be pretty careful with my money. And so this has kind of led to a lifelong worry about, you know, at any point that I might not be financially sustainable. And so I've, you know, always had these moments where I've been, how am I going to raise two kids in New York City? Or, you know, how am I going to pay my student loans, you know, all of these worries over the years. And, you know, I've been pretty lucky and things have worked out for me in large part. And, you know, I've always been able to manage those things. So if I could go back to my younger self, I would just say, don't worry so much. You know, it's going to be okay. You know,
if you didn't worry, you wouldn't have done so well.
Maybe. But I think that's fair. I wish I had worried a little less. Of course, I'm pretty sure that in 20 years, I'd like to come say to myself again now. So I think it's just a perpetual.
Well, that is good advice. But I certainly hear you. And I also worry a lot about money because I'm, you know, largely undercompensated.
Thank you, everybody. No, Ellen, you've been a fantastic guest. The time flew by and it was very, very interesting.
It is very interesting. And we do actually have a pair of socks, boxes and lined socks for you. They're lovely, luxurious socks.
We have some right there.
Oh, we do.
John, present them.
These are not of our
colorful batch, but
they're very nice.
The comfort, and they will usually last about a time where you want to come next on the podcast.
Okay, perfect.
That's our hook to get you back.
All right. Oh, they're great. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And boxes and lines, John, send us out.
Over and out. God bless you all.
Cheers. Are you a diehard boxer or liner, or just a fair weather fan? No judgments, I know how annoying JR's Irish accent can be. Either way, we want to hear from you on our new Boxes and Lines listener survey to find out what you think about the show, give input on future episodes, guests, and more. We'll take it back to our survey counter thingy machine and consider all of your inputs as we plan our 2024 season. You can find the survey at iex.getfeedback.com/boxesandlines. And don't worry, there's something in it for you. That's my drum roll. JR could probably do it better. You get a pair of socks. That's right, take the survey. We'll send you a pair of our coveted Box and Lines socks while supplies last in a new limited edition print. How's that for listener appreciation? So take the survey, tell us what you think, and thanks for listening. Again, that's iex.getfeedback.com/boxesandlines. Over and out.
Boxes and Lines is a podcast from IEX Exchange. It is hosted by Ronan Ryan and John Ramsey, executive produced by Daisy Clace, with support from Benstown. For more information and to hear more episodes, go to iexexchange.io/podcast. Thank you for listening to Boxes and Lines. The information and opinions expressed in this podcast are provided for informational and educational purposes only, and IEX Group Incorporated and its affiliates do not make any representations or warranties as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Nothing in this podcast constitutes a solicitation or offer to buy or sell any securities or provide any investment advice or service. Some portions of the preceding conversation may have been edited for length or clarity. Copyright IEX Group Incorporated, all rights reserved.